Welcome to another inspiring episode of Lights, Camera, Baby, brought to you by Mama Magic. I'm your host, Progeny Patha, and today we're diving into one of the most meaningful journeys in parenting, raising resilient, kind, and confident children. It's a topic close to every parent's heart, and we're thrilled to have a guest who brings both professional expertise and personal insight to the conversation. Joining us is Kelly Grace, Pedagogy Head for DIBA International South Africa. Kelly's impressive background includes an honors degree in counseling psychology, a PGCE in foundation phase teaching, and a certification in sports psychology. Now, she's been shaping young minds and supporting families since the age of 19, and with experience spanning classrooms, charitable foundations, and even state agencies. But what truly sets Kelly apart is her lived experience as a mum of two boys, one of whom is on the autism spectrum, just like herself. Kelly's passion for inclusive education and her dedication to fostering supportive environments is nothing short of inspiring. Today, she'll be sharing her wisdom and practical tips for helping families navigate the beautiful, challenging journey of raising emotionally strong and empathetic children. So grab a cup of coffee or settle in for a stroller walk. It's time to dive in. So Kelly, thank you so much for joining us today. We are so interested in listening to the inspiration behind this topic that we have. I mean, understanding resilience, kindness, and confidence. You know, those are such big words, and sometimes it's just taken for granted. So warm welcome to you. Appreciate you being here.
Thank you for having me. It's a privilege to be here. I think it's a long time coming, and I'm just hopeful that it gives insight to what I didn't have as a first-time mom or going through studies. I think there's a big difference between, you know, studying something, working with it, yes, and then living it is completely different.
Completely. And I think that's the most beautiful part about all the mums that I meet. It's just wanting to empower all other mums and new mums so that you can make those changes. And that's what we're here for at Mama Magic as well. So let's talk about resilience and kindness and confidence. You know, how do we instill this in children? Or what do these qualities look like in children? You know, they might be there and they might be glaring. And parents think, you know, we need to grow these children into responsible young adults. But how do we lay the foundation early enough for those kind of qualities to start to appear? Because it's not they're going to become a teenager or become adults and it will just all of a sudden, it's there, right?
I think the understanding is that when, especially new moms, first time moms, I think there's this misconception that if I read 1,000 books or what to expect, it's going to give me the answer. Yeah. And at the end of the day, it's not. Each child, like I say to parents when I train or I train teachers, they don't come with a manual. They don't come with the how, the why, the when. But it also adds chapters onto it. So if I look at it from my perspective, not knowing that I was on the spectrum and then having a spectrum child, that's another layer to add on where you sit and you compare. Aaron didn't talk at a certain age. And even with my qualification and with my background, I ignored it. So to ask what it looks like is it looks very different. Yeah. Every family's resilience level, forgiveness level, whatever that level is, will be different. But the pathways that we can go about addressing it can be common. And yeah, that's what it needs to look like. It needs to suit the family that it's created or grafted for, in yeah, that sense.
I mean, if you think about those words, immediately what springs to mind for me is, like, we say, talk about resilience, but there's a fine line between being resilient, being tough, and being a bully, right? And then, you know, there's a fine line between being kind and being, you know, being a pushover, right? Or being confident, but being overly assertive and not being wary of people around you, right? So there's, you know, as much as we want to instill those things, it can go the other way. So how do we, you know, it's interesting discussion as to how do we create those environments where we can build on those without going over the line?
I think the first thing to start off with is the idea of resilience. And for me, resilience is being okay to fail. It is being okay to not be the best all the time. There is something of growing up and accepting the fact that there is somebody always better than you. And that's okay. It can be better, but it's almost like finding your way.
Yeah.
A mentor once said to me, because I struggle with the idea of a specialist. I struggle with the idea of being called a top specialist or whatever that looks like. And the issue that I have with it is that I might have specialized in a certain area like development or teaching, but I'm still evolving. Yes. I'm still learning. I'm still progressing. I'm still going forward, but there's still failure in that and there's still testing. And how I bounce back from that is going to represent what resilience looks like. There is a massive difference between resilience and bullying. Bullying doesn't exist in an ECD framework. It was an article that I wrote earlier this year about bullying from a heartfelt perspective, where schools are about boundaries. Schools are about learning the social implications of what happens when we come together.
Yes.
Resilience can be, I'm standing up for me, but I'm not hurting others or hurting myself in the progressive way that I do it. If I'm resilient, it is an idea of I can bounce back when I've fallen off, or if I've failed, I can come back around. Parents need to come to the understanding in a very crude way. We are, to an extent, going to mess up our children a little bit. We are going to falter and we are going to crash in some ways, and that's okay. But how we then teach them how to get back up or how to learn or how to become accountable, that's where the resilience. I don't have to bully someone to make sure I am resilient. It is a personal effect. It is not supposed to hurt or deter other people from doing
that. That's true. That I love that. And I mean, if you think about it, you make me think about a little baby who's learning to walk, right? And every time they take a few steps, they fall down again, right? And they can either sit there and not want to move forever, or they can get up, right? And that goes, that's probably the start of resilience, maybe.
It is. It is the beginning. It's how we do get back up. But it's then also important on the parent of the reaction that they give a child.
Yes.
We tend to overprotect. It's nature. We don't want anything. As a mother, you know, your bear instincts, your mama bear instincts kick in. But it's how do we address it? It's the same when children fall and hurt themselves. And there's a big discrepancy, I think, in girls and boys, how we react, where that idea of boy code comes up. A little girl and a little boy falling should receive the same reaction.
Mm.
How have you hurt? Acknowledge the hurt, acknowledge the feeling, and move forward. That builds resiliency for the next time that it happens, when someone's not around.
Yes.
To overreact, the child then learns, oh, this is what happens when I get hurt. You haven't given them a coping skill. You haven't given them a step in how to build. So the next time a bigger facet or a bigger issue comes up, that resilience is not there because somebody was there to protect it.
Yeah, because mom was there to fix it.
Yes, all the time.
Mommy will be there to fix it. Dad will be there to fix it. So immediately the child starts to turn instead of trying to figure it out.
Or becomes complacent on, no, somebody else will be there. And then where do we build independency? Because I think resilience comes with independence, and it's something that we foster specifically now with the Bella Bill coming into effect, with grade R becoming compulsory, with the hope that 4 to 5 will become compulsory. Where does that independence lie? If I cannot pack my own school bag, who is going to do it for me later in life? But there's a balance. I think there's a balance between heavy resilience and support.
Mm.
And we've got to somehow meet children in the middle of that. But again, that looks different for every parent or every struggle that a child might be facing. I wouldn't say to a parent who has an autistic child, in terms of building their resilience, will look at the same as a child who's not neurodivergent. There's a difference between it, and it has to meet the child where they're at. It's not the parent's expectation, but the expectation we then put on the child in order to grow it forward.
Yeah. Wow. You're giving me so much to think about. And I think that often as parents, when we listen to things like this, we look at things that we've done, you know, and have I done that? Have I not done that? You know, how could I have done it better? But at the same time, it's never too late.
No, it's not. And the biggest, I think, the last 5 years has taught me, specifically with my eldest son, is that parents tend to judge other parents. And I think they do it from the perspective of, if I pick out something that's necessarily wrong about them, they won't see the flaws that I have.
Mm.
And I think growing up with children and now learning and having my own, is we kind of need to bridge that idea of why am I taking criticism from someone I will not seek advice from? Why am I looking for that where it's not supposed to be? It doesn't exist. Oh. So then again, the idea, why am I taking criticism from those I would not seek advice from? And that's the idea with being on the spectrum, is that we've had to learn that. We've had to learn, where do you seek the advice? Where do you build that? How do you build that? And I think parents listen too much at the world and how the world perceives it, where they can trust their own gut. They can know right from wrong. And if they are protecting their child to the best of their ability, it's not for me to judge on that as well. Again, as long as it is not hurting them and those around them in the same way.
Of course. So then let's move to kindness, right? How do you build a quality like kindness? I always remember the song. I always think about the little songs that, you know, Barney was a big fan in our home, and it was all about sharing, you know, and sharing is caring. But those little activities do help. But what are your thoughts on that?
I think kindness can be innate if it is encouraged correctly. With Dibba, and it's something that I really enjoy about them, they have a very heartwarming fundamental, and it's called heart culture. And heart culture is the I, you, and we. And how does the I affect the you to affect the we? But it has to start with me. Kindness is simple things. Kindness is a simple thank you. Kindness is a gesture, and it can be encouraged through positive reinforcement. As parents, I so often hear the word no, or I heard don't do that. What about encouraging the good or acknowledging the good through praise? When we train teachers, we speak a lot about specific praise. We speak about how you need to praise the action for what it is worth and the value that it holds. Mm-hmm. So I'm not eclectically going to say to a staff, staff or child or whatever the case may be, well done. I'm going to give you the specific. So I'm going to say, yes, well done for being nice to your brother. Well done for doing such a nice thing for me, whatever that thing may be. And that language then breeds the next step of kindness. Kindness is seeing I affecting you to affect we. And it's simple things. It's picking up things, saying thank you. I don't think enough parents say thank you when their child does something right. We sort of just expect it. How can I expect a child to say thank you if I don't say thank you? Sort of out of the babes of mouths. My youngest last night specifically, you know, Granny didn't do something. And he went, but you didn't say thank you. Acknowledge you've been called out on it, to say, yes, I actually didn't. Yeah. It was wrong. We can't just go say thank you if we ourselves don't mirror it. So I think kindness is a mirror. Mm-hmm. It comes from the parents. It comes from language. It comes of how we treat others, especially partners as well, in relationships, marriage, whatever that relationship looks like. And our
children are watching all 100%, the time.
And they're mirroring that. Again, it goes back. We are going to mess up our kids at some point. We take on what our elders did to us or our family members. I don't parent the way my mom parented. I don't, and I don't think neither do anyone, because we remember the hard parts.
Yes.
How much of parenting of our parents do we remember the good? Very little. And if we can mimic that kindness, and we can mimic something as simple as forgiveness. South Africa is very rich in this idea of Ubuntu, but we don't act in it. Yes. We don't live it. We sort of take it on as a saying, or this is community. But it's general small actions that create, again, the I, the you, and the we.
I love that. I, the you, and the we. And it's so impactful.
And it is. And that's heart culture. For Dibba, it's something that we pride in. And heart culture must also be remembered. Heart culture is not about getting your way. Heart culture is about being fair when times are hard. How would I address it? We also ride on a very, which I have taken very much to heart in the articles that I've written, of we are building a child for the heart of the world. That is where I need to be. Inclusiveness is as well. I am teaching you how to be kind to the next child. I have seen many children, many adults, not understand my son or not understand me, and then go back to the point of the child's being rude.
Mm.
No. That's how we need to accept people, and that's where kindness comes in. It's not the pointing or the glaring or what I found the worst about being an autistic mom is your child doesn't look autistic, or stop using your autism as an excuse. How does that breed kindness? If we are constantly questioning other parents of their children, they're hearing that, and it's hard. So kindness is not little. It is full actions every single day.
Yep.
It is the language, the body behavior, how we talk. children mimic us on the phone. And that was a big wake up call for me with my youngest, especially when I've been on irritating phone calls or phone calls I don't want to be on. And I snap at people. And it's happened. It's all happened. How does that interpret how he then speaks to people? Because that's not kind. It's not addressing the issue at hand. Yes. Kindness is understanding and being accountable. And then it resides in the resilient. Because again, you can be resilient, but you can be resilient with kindness. You don't have to. That then again separates the bully.
Yes, that is true. That is true. And then how do we bring confidence into this?
Confidence again comes from praise. It's about acknowledging a child that they can and they will. I had a very amazing saying when I taught was, there's no such word as I can't unless you have tried. Confidence comes from that. And I think bullying brings it down, because that's the idea of bullying. Because if you look at bullying, it's about bringing another person down. It didn't start in South Africa. It actually started in America. It's a way of leveling.
Right.
Where confidence, if I instill proper, when I mean proper confidence, I mean structured confidence. It's not about being arrogant that you brought up.
Yes.
Why can't we say we've done something confidently? If we say it too much, then we boast.
Mm.
But it's something that I agree with. And autistics do this. We often will monopolize a conversation. And the reason we'll do it is we're not doing it to compete with you. We're trying to get to the point where we understand the conversation that we're having. So if you bring up something in relevance that is relevant to you, we will acknowledge it with a story of our own to make sure that we understand it.
I see.
And that's where our confidence comes from. Most autistic children will shy away because we don't know what to say in those social cues.
Right.
But having someone with kindness and having that confidence, we can then join in it. And that's where the balance comes in.
Now, when we talk about these three words, and it's something that we all want to strive for, and I think it's an essential part of building the foundation for a future society. How do we start to instill this, and from what age can you do this? You know, how old, you know, can this work from, you know, when you bring baby home? Is it when they start crawling, when they're walking, or when they, you know, are ready to go to school? You know, when does it switch in?
It switches in from the day of birth. Babies can hear you. And this is a very big misconception I have, specifically with 1 to 2 teachers, where they think they are not impactful. They are. Your home, how your child feels in your home, that is where it comes from. It's day one. It's not a certain point of, in this milestone on this day, I am going to do this with my child.
Yes.
Children hear things. It's why psychologists will say to you, don't fight in front of your children. They pick up on all those little things. They are absorbing words. We often sit when we develop programs or vocab programs, we start with the big words from very little. And it's the idea that if a child can rat off Tyrannosaurus Rex, they will pick up words. They will pick up. It's from the day we come home, because then you set that routine. So you set that habit where this house is about kindness. There is a very big idea with language and words. And I think it's often what parents miss out is they don't label emotions. When your child is feeling frustrated, give the word frustration. I can see you are frustrated. I can see you are angry, because then you create the safe space that I can bring this information to you. Most autistic children will have their worst meltdowns with their mother figure because it's a safe space. Nobody will judge me. Nobody will hurt me. I can behave like this and get it out because it's a safe space. If you create that safe space from day one, then you are breeding an atmosphere where I can come tell you I've made a mistake or I need additional support. Mm-hmm. But if we shut it off and we don't speak about it, when is it going to happen?
And that makes so much sense, because I mean, you know, you look at so many little children and people say, oh, can you believe this little 4-month-old or 5-month-old is doing, you know, saying the word no. Or, you know, doing something that we think it's absolutely funny because it's such an adult-like behavior. And this child is just a few months old and is able to do this. But again, they're mimicking what they see around them. And we don't realize that. Or when they pick up your phone on the bed, it's because they're mimicking what you do all the time. It's those little things. And you see it already, but you don't understand their level of intelligence already at as young as they are, right?
And again, at Dibba, and this is why I love them so much, is that they breathe this idea into us of, what if a child knew how valuable they were? What if a child knew from the get-go that they can and they could and they will.
Yeah.
And that being in that valuable bubble, they can accomplish so much, and they do. And parents sort of like get excited when these things happen, but it's from them that it is happening. How engaged are you as a mom?
Yeah.
And I don't think things like postpartum depression are spoken about. Some moms have horrific births and they zone out. Women have described they zone out. There's psychology words that are associated where they didn't bond with their child or they don't remember that. And you feel guilty because then you get other people who say to you, but have you done this yet? But have you done that yet? And all you want to be is in that bubble of being a mom. And I think we take it for granted. Your children are only that age that day.
Yeah.
And I think there's so much this conformed pressure to then align with milestones. And I think this is where parents get confused.
Yes.
Milestones are not set in stone. It's a guideline of a specific age. And I think that's where it came to bite back at me a little bit. Now looking back, being diagnosed and being on the spectrum, I spoke fluently at 9 months, where my parents attributed that to intelligence and they attributed it. And I had very much older siblings. I'm very much what we call a lotlomachy.
Yeah.
I have a 10 and 13 year age gap between my siblings and myself. So they assumed that because I was around older children and older adults, that language came in. But if you look at when I worked confidently at only 18 months. There's a big gap, which they didn't pick up in the 90s because autism wasn't spoken about and nor was it seen in girls.
Yeah.
And it missed the bar. Where I had a close friend who was male and was diagnosed with ADHD off the bat, I wasn't. And the gap started separating as well.
Absolutely.
And that's where I think parents miss that fall short as well. We don't have to sit and live in comparison, but we do have to understand our child. Again, going back, I ignored my son's autism for a year. I literally put blinker blinders on it and went, this is not me. It's not. It can't be. You're wrong. It's not.
Yeah.
But then having to come to it in my own way, that's where the difference then comes in as well.
So if we had a look at practical strategies for families, like, you know, we look at emotional intelligence, right? How can we help children identify and express their feelings through this, you know, building resilience and kindness and confidence? How do we, you know, help them build these, you know, identify what are the words, what can parents physically do?
I think the most important thing in that element is communication. And I think then reading comes into it, that bonding time of language and acknowledgement. And I think it's spending time. The root of family needs to come back. We are so engulfed in technology and we are so engulfed in a TV, a raid, whatever the case may be, that family communication has broken down. What parents can do, put the phones away, have dinners with your children, speak to your newborn, speak, read. They can hear it. They know that it's there. Practical is being involved. It is what we call in DIBA an engaged educator.
Yeah.
Be an engaged parent. Be with your children in those moments, but then understand that they need the space to find the independence. If a child finds interest in something that is not hurting them, allow them to play with it. Play in the mud with them. Play in the sandpit with them. Get dirty with them. Yeah. I love children. I love watching children become dirty because I think it's the way of learning and we can learn alongside of them. There is a theory, and I love it. It's called the power of I don't know.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it's such a beautiful way of thinking where teachers have this assumption, and I think parents have this assumption as well, that we have to have all the answers. And we don't. We don't. There's no such thing.
But when you get asked that and you're so stumped to say, I don't know, as a parent feels like, oh, I'm just letting down my child.
No. Why can't I learn with you? Again, resilience. You're expecting your child to know everything. How is that fair? Mm-hmm. You are only a parent as long as your child has been alive.
That's true.
How can we not just learn with them? I have seen the greatest of teachers who have sat and taught outer space and have had a child stump them with a question, only to then say to the child, and she was brilliant in this, and she said, I don't know. Can I go find out and come back and tell you?
Yeah.
And the child went, yes, can I learn with you?
Aww.
There's a beautiful nature in it because then it gives the love of learning.
Yes.
You asked earlier, when do we start? From the beginning.
Right.
Let children choose. Let them have the option. What is a practical way to do it when our child is becoming appropriate, when 2 turning 3? Why are we not taking them into bookstores and allowing them to choose books that interest them?
Mm.
Why does it have to stem from the parent? Why must we get the same Dr. Seuss book or the same book that we read? Maybe there is differences, and acknowledge those differences in your children. Yes, they are mini versions of you, but it's not your ego that you're building. It's their confidence that
you're
building.
I like what you're saying there as well, because you're giving them a chance to say that we're not perfect, right? We don't need to always do this. And secondly, it's about saying, it's okay to make mistakes. It's okay to say, I don't know. We dropped it. We didn't know. And then it's also okay to, because you feel safe, right? I mean, you're creating a safe space where you're saying, this is how kindness works, in a safe space.
But we must then also give them the acknowledgement that the world is hard. And I think that's what parents are scared to do. The world is frightening. It is not the world that it was 20 years ago. It's not the world that my parents have lived in with their children. But we need to build that resilience to say failure can happen.
Yes.
And we have to create what I love. There's an analogy called the circle of trust or a circle of attachment. How we attach to our kids and how we build that confidence and that trust in them is how they will then perceive the world. I have seen children's confidence break in the smallest of ways. Parents not picking up on time. You've broken that level of trust. I trusted you to be there, but you've given me reason not to trust it. It's the same with fulfilling promises. How many parents have tried to bargain with their kids or bribe, but then you don't follow through on the bribe? What does that show them about the trust of my word or of the world? The world is going to fail them at some point, or they're not going to get the job that they want. But then how do you build up that as well? And what I love is I read a thing a couple of weeks ago on an artist that was commenting on Taylor Swift, for an example, when she didn't win Album of the Year. And there's a video that plays where she says, I have to try again harder next time. She takes on the accountability. I failed myself.
Yep.
I didn't say my music producer or those that wrote for me or those that helped. I failed. I need to do better. But then it's acknowledging that failure can be a safe space. We shouldn't be quick to punish or when the fall shorts come, because we sort of put those expectations on our children of what our parents did.
Yeah.
And my mom and dad were very different in that. My mom was, when I brought home the 90, it was where it was the 100. Where my dad came from a different cuff, where it was as long as you get 50, you pass. But there's nothing wrong in how my mom did. She just saw my value a little bit higher. Yeah. Where my dad was more the gentler one to say, please just get through it. And that's okay. But they're different. Absolutely. She was an ICU nurse. He is an engineer. Very different fields. And it's accepting that. And it's also taking from parents not to then push the academics so much, because we see that in preschools. Parents, why is my child not counting to 100? Why is my child not doing this? Maybe they're not interested in doing it.
Right now.
Why must I build a 50-piece puzzle if I don't like the picture of the puzzle?
Course.
My son builds his puzzles upside down.
2 seconds. Sorry, hold on.
No worries. Oh, dear. Oh, dear. Oh, dear.
That is so good. No, your mom and dad.
But they are, and they're different people. And there's nothing wrong in that. Their view of the world, they were raised by different people, they're in different industries. And again, this goes back to the academic. Why can't children learn to be hands-on? Why can't they go that route? I think parents think their child is leveled on their level of intelligence because it shows how intelligent they are.
Yeah.
It's not your journey. It is theirs.
Yes.
You are there to guide them and hold them, support them, and create independency within that in your own way.
Now, how do we, through all of this, how do we balance, you know, to build confidence? We want to praise and we want to encourage, but how do we balance that and constructive feedback? You know, you didn't get it right just yet, but how, physically, you know,
I think it comes from, there was a phenomenal, when I worked with a guy a couple of years ago who always taught us that criticism, you wrap in a box and you neatly wrap it. And when you unwrap it, it's got to be a slow process because you don't want to rip the paper. So you have to make sure that it's met with acknowledgement, but it is met with praise within that acknowledgement. So it's not just about saying, oh, you did it wrong.
Yes.
Let's talk about why you did it wrong. Let's understand the why, which again, Dibber's fundamentals, and I love it. The why.
Yeah.
Why did it go wrong? What could you have done better? Is it in your control? Because then you've broken it down into their understanding. We often go, you've done that wrong, go to your room, or whatever the way that we discipline as parents. But do we actually acknowledge the conversation? Do we actually go and say, this is why I got angry, or this is why we spoke about it? Because you can't bounce with children. You can't be one way with one reaction and one way with another. It's the same with divorced parents. You can't give in on one note and then say no on the other. We That's have true. To be on the same playing field. How many children break something and hide it? Because they're scared of what it brings. But if I know that I'm instilling an idea of children to say that if you make a mistake, yes, I will be angry, but this is why I will be angry, we can walk away and we can come back to that.
Would the same apply then, or should the same not apply to when, so if you're doing something wrong, so you'd be able to understand what you've done and why it's wrong. But at the same time, you know, when you're saying thank you, for example, to understand what you're being thankful for, like, so you brought mom her slippers, or you made mom a cup of tea, or mom played with you, you know, and it's thank you for playing with me, or mom's thanking you. I had such fun playing with you. Thank you, you know, for spending time with me, or an apology. You know, people are very often, I feel sometimes apologies from adults are so empty because I'm not sure whether you know what you're sorry for.
But how often do we apologize to our children in the same breath when we've done something wrong?
Yes, very true.
I've often been criticized, obviously coming from a home with an autistic adult and an autistic child. It is a bomb waiting to go off, right. Especially if he starts getting high-pitched. I'm very sensory overloaded. I often have to say to my autistic son, I'm getting frustrated. I need to walk away.
Yeah.
And I often say to him, please, you are upsetting me. I need the space. What is wrong with that? What is wrong with saying to a child, you have upset me? Because then they acknowledge they have done something.
Yeah, how old is he now?
So Aaron will be 7 in February. And remember, he's partially nonverbal. He's only started speaking. His language understanding is phenomenal, but he's only started to use words recently.
Right.
But I've given him those words to say, Aaron, I'm getting angry. And sometimes he'll walk up to me and go, Mommy, are you angry? Because then he's acknowledged what that feeling is. We need to say thank you specifically to our children when they've done something right, because that's where they get acknowledgement. People pleasers as adults. How many of us are people pleasers? Because I believe it came from a lack of that thank.
Yeah,
a lack of that. True. We always want to be one up.
Yeah.
But how about we celebrate another parent? How about, again, the same with a parent as it is with a child when you talk about acknowledgement.
Mm-hmm.
How many mothers actually turn to each other and go, you're doing a good job? Very few and far between. In the parents that I've sat with on this journey, because I didn't have anyone other than family when Aaron got his diagnosis, it was hard. And there was no one there to talk to. And often I'll sit with parents who get their diagnoses and they sit with it and they're in it. And I go, but you're a good mom. And a large majority of them will turn around and go, nobody said that to me. Nobody acknowledged that I was good.
So do you think that has changed your parenting style?
Yes. A lot of the time, it's hard. But there's a lot of criticism even within the autistic community, because a lot of us, we do. Parents are parents. We're keyboard warriors. We know what it is.
Yeah.
And I remember when Aaron got diagnosed initially, we had to move him out of the school that he was in because he was having intensive meltdowns. And it wasn't fair on the teacher as well. And it got to the point where we left his first proper preschool. And I remember putting on one of the groups and I remember saying, I need to make the decision. He has to go spend 8 weeks with Granny because we had to find an appropriate school for him in that time. We couldn't just rush and jump into a school.
Mm-hmm.
And the amount of moms who came back and said that I was abandoning my child was horrific.
Oh,
it was hard. But that comes from their own issues. It doesn't stem from what I need. And the moms that did support me, I've never met, and I still speak on WhatsApp regularly, or I phone them. And that's where community is built. But it's them saying, it's okay.
Yeah.
It's fine to feel like this.
Yeah.
But again, are we doing it to our children as well? Are we acknowledging their strength? Are we acknowledging their strength as a mom?
Yes.
And that's the difficulty with autism. You meet one autistic person or child, it means you have met one. They are not the same, and a parent's difficulty is not my difficulty. I know a few parents who I've had the luxury of meeting and, you know, seeing their children, and I often go, we are lucky. There are certain things that some children still struggle with that we didn't even think about. Aaron eats every type of food. Every type of food. Right. Where some autistic children live on noodles and nuggets. And the idea in the autistic community is fairness based. If my child has eaten today, that's great.
That's okay.
Where other parents will criticize that and be like, how could you give them nuggets for the 440th time? Well, because my child needed to eat and that's what we need to do. But here is where the criticism is.
Exactly. And I don't think it's just in the autistic community. I think parents generally, look at other parents and how they parent. And, your way is not always the best way. Your way works for you and your family. But something else works for me and my child.
And that's respectful, again, right? As long as it is not hurting them,
yes,
and others around them.
Exactly. And our circumstances are so different as well. You know, we try to tick so many boxes and there's always so much as moms that we try to do and to fulfill and to make everything so special. And every occasion and every milestone and every year, that it's just daunting. And the last thing you want is somebody to beat you down and criticize you for not being as good as them or not doing what they think is the right way.
But it's bred. And I think it comes from everyone else. How often do you sit in a mom group where somebody brings up something and you go, oh, that's not my problem that I have to deal with. But how about we support the mom that's struggling with that? We don't have to tell them what to do, but we can create a safe space. Again, there's that safe space where we don't have that safe space, where we're expected to be up and clean. And I've seen the posts often where it's, I didn't get laundry done today, but your child slept on you the whole day. That was a moment you're never going to get back and you're going to miss.
And you'll be doing laundry for the rest of your life.
And they'll hopefully be doing it with you. But that's where independence then comes from. And I think the sense of family has depleted so much. I think a lot of the family that is around us, we don't go to moms as often as we could for the fear of that criticism. Oh, you should know better, or you should have known that. Even from between my first child to my second child, I was lost the second time around.
How old is the second one?
So he's exactly 19 months to the day behind his brother. So even going through it the 19 months before, I'd forgotten how to burp. I'd forgotten all those little things. And you do, because it becomes part of the practice norm.
Yeah.
But we missed out on a lot of that time as well. And again, circumstances. I had to leave to Botswana with my in-laws for additional support because that is where they were living at the time.
Now, we spoke about, these qualities that we want in our children, how we can model it as parents and how we can build it at home. But then the next phase of life for our little babies is to try to figure out, where are they going to be? Is it an early learning center? A lot of them are being left at creche or a play school before they start big school. There's different levels. And what should we be looking for in these spaces as parents so that, we find a space that supports what we're doing at home?
Right? I think it's very much up to the parent themselves and it's their viewpoint. And we as educators can't criticize that. If a parent's safety nest is that the child starts school at 2,
yes,
that is their prerogative. It's what they choose to have. In an ideal world, I think children should start school as soon as they possibly can. And the reason I say that is because the misconception about preschool, play school is that we go there to learn. No, we go there to socialize. We go there to learn cues from other children.
Social cues.
That's my children both, not by choice, had to start school at 8 weeks old. They didn't have that choice. I didn't have the luxury of UIF, a double come in household. There is a choice that I made. Have I seen the difference in children that go to school late versus early? Yes, the integration is difficult because of the attachment. If I only know mom, and this is what COVID did, I only know mom, I do not trust the world around me. It's not fair. We need to understand that attachment is grown. Secure attachment is important. Knowing that if I go somewhere, mommy will come back. It's the same thing we say to parents when they start the first day. If you're going to cry, that's fine. Give me your little one. Go cry away. Because then they trigger, mom is crying. This is not a safe space for me to be in. That's what school is going to be. What does an education center look like? It should look like home. It should look like an extension of you as a parent. Mm-hmm. And that for me is why I was drawn so much to Diva, is because it is that home. It is that family. It is that way of that connectiveness, that a way of understanding where we're from, that it carries on at home as it does at school. The school you are looking for should suit your ideals and your comfortability. I can walk into schools and know if a child is going to fit there because it's the way that I feel about the space as well. The earlier, the better. And no, I'm not criticizing the moms that choose to do it later, but I'm saying in an ideal world, the sooner you do it, the sooner you then get yourself back. There is no more joy than picking up a child after school. I absolutely love doing it. I didn't do it as a teacher for many, many years because often they were with me at the same school. Now that they are at their own school, concerts, pickup times, all of that, the running to you is phenomenal. And them expressing what they've done for the day.
Yeah.
I've done this today, or I learned this.
Beautiful.
Parents enjoy that little time because I remember getting into the car in grade, I think it was grade 8 or grade 9, and my mom would ask me how was school and I'd go, fine. And that's the extent of the sentence that you get, where now with my youngest, it's, I drew this today, I painted this today, this person got into trouble, this person. There's joy in that. And it also sets routine.
Yes.
Routine is important. Even if you are at home with your children, you have to set that tone of routine. Children thrive on routine and structure. It is a very big misconception that they don't. They do. And they love familiarity. It's the same thing as the autistic world. We thrive on routine. We're taught from a very early age with our children.
Yes.
Stick to that routine. But then you've got to learn to throw a ball and curve. So you've got to be able to throw those changes and then see what they do when they bounce back from it as well. Again, the resilience comes
in. The resilience. Now, I've heard so much about Dibber having such a different approach, a holistic approach when it comes to child-centered education. Share a little bit more about that with us.
What I love about Dibber is the idea of play, that play breeds imagination and exploration, and we learn through those pockets. Play, it's centered, it's independent. We find who we are in that sense. And that's what I love about that holistic idea of a child. We are not just learning the ABCs, we're learning the fundamentals through reading. And what's really, really great about Dibber is they take the whole concrete approach of that holistic play and they thrive in the independency of it as well. We call them zones. We call them interactive zones. And they're different ones for the different learning areas that we do. And a child is free to explore that in their own. It's guided by the teacher,
right,
but it's their interpretation of it. We've had plenty of children in our construction areas who they're supposed to be building houses in our mind, but they turned them into musical instruments. There's nothing wrong with that. It's their perception of it. A child sees different things. And that's the same with adulthood. How we are expected to walk out of high school and know exactly what we're going to do is very limited. But with Dibber, it is a holistic approach. It is their imagination lit on fire. It is about that exploration. It's about being engaged and guiding their learning of the why. I love the word why. I think it's such a critical element that children should be asking why. That 450 whys that you get in a day, don't ignore them because it's sparking an interest you didn't know that they might have.
Absolutely.
And it's letting them lead it. If they want a certain color or they want a certain thing, ask why. I don't think enough parents ask why.
Yeah.
And that's what Dibber does, is it asks the why and it gives them the direction through engaged educators to meet the child where they're at. And to give them more. There's no such thing, and this is why I have a little bit of an issue with CAPS every now and then, is it boxes children to say, you need to know this before you go to another age group. But what if I know more? What if I don't want to know more? What if my interest is art and I see beauty in art or I read the world in art? But some children see it as a math.
Right.
Where I like adding things. I like, that's where imagination comes from. That's where we learn what we want to do our whole lives. If you had asked me 12 years ago that I would be with children, I would have laughed at you because I was petrified of them. I was absolutely petrified of children until I started all-pairing a family of five. They had five kids and I loved it. But if I hadn't found that interest and I hadn't explored it, then I wouldn't be here today.
Yeah.
And Dibber does that. They grow their teachers as well as they grow their children. Every classroom is different. It is not the same. And when we design curriculum for them, we don't look at it in terms of you have to follow this set of instructions. Teachers are not created. They are born. They know where that direction is. And I have a lot of different friends who've had a lot of different backgrounds, and some have had hardships, some haven't had hardships. And I remember having a conversation a couple of years ago with a friend of mine, just as I finished going, when I went into curriculum eventually. And he turned to me and he said to me, where were you when I was a kid? Because I think if somebody had heard me, and I think if somebody had tried to see what I was going through, maybe my life would be different. Maybe it would be a different approach. And that's what scooting should be. It shouldn't be boxed and closed. It should be open and interpretive. It should be their own direction.
Kelly, as your parting words for today, it's just been truly, truly insightful. And I think many parents will probably want to go and listen to this a few times over.
I hope so.
Because there's so many nuggets in here, I think, and so much of support and actionable ways that parents can take this forward and make small changes. But, you know, what would be your advice for your parting words for parents who are, we know, are trying to raise children to be resilient, confident, and kind, like we said, in such a complex world? What is the one or two things that you would leave them with today?
I think know your own child for yourself. Don't sit comparatively to siblings, to other families. Know and understand your child. Know that they're different in their own way and it's okay, and acknowledge that okay space, that they can be anything they want to be and it's free of judgment.
Yeah.
That's what we need. To grow that independence, I think, is very important. And I think the other thing is to be more here. Be more there with your child. Take away the elements of that and just play. I love sitting in the garden and lying with my son and looking at the sky, because there's beauty within that. And I think that's being lost. Yes. That idea of being engaged with a child, just play. I think there's such
now
a beauty.
We sit together and
play.
Look at our phones.
But we do. And that's the sad part. And then we watch them go towards a tablet, but then we take the tablet away from them because, oh, no, now it's too much.
Yes.
Parents need to understand their children for who they are and accept the difference and the uniqueness within it and grow it and encourage it to be different. And don't ever put the no in front of them. I think no is the wrong word. I don't like no. I don't like, there is a different way. And we've seen it with teachers as well. How often do we sit in a class and get so depressed because all we've done the whole day is go, no, don't do that. Don't touch that. Well, what if we went with them? And what if we learned something with them and we saw the beauty? And that for me is the special thing about being autistic. There's a lot of controversy within the autistic community of, do we label these children superheroes who have superpowers? I do see mine as a superpower because I see it as a different way to connect with children. It's a radar. It's there and it's an understanding to see it. And there's beauty in that. There's privilege in that. Yeah. It's not something that's given freely. It's the same idea of if a child hands you a rock and it's a phone and it's ringing, answer it.
Yeah.
Engagement is important from the day of birth all the way through. But then my final thought is that give them independence into that. Allow the confidence to bloom. Give them the challenge. Again, it's not hurting them and it's not hurting others. Why is it wrong?
Mm.
Parenting is beautiful and it's a privilege, and some parents don't get that opportunity as well. True. With the issues that we face today in terms of fertility, in terms of that. Hold on to it, but hold on it loosely enough that it can grow. And that's the best thing I can do. And again, my last thought, do not take compliments or conflict or anything from those that you would not seek advice from.
Yes.
It's very important
that
to
is
know
truly,
that.
Truly important.
You do not need the criticism. But if you're going to someone that you know will give you the advice, and you don't always have to take it. That was the one thing I got told when I was a first-time mom is, you can acknowledge it and let it go.
Yeah.
Thank you for telling me that. I'll consider it. But it doesn't mean you have to take it on. If it doesn't work for you,
Don't.
It's as simple as that. You will protect your child in the way that you know how, in your own way.
Yeah.
And there'll be chapters added and things will be thrown off. But I think there's no such thing as the perfect child. There's no such thing as the perfect parent. But there is beauty in imperfection. And that's where parents need to grow from.
Well, Kelly, thank you so very much for all the insights. It's truly, truly insightful. And like I said, I know I'm going to go back to this a few times. Your heartfelt wisdom really struck a chord with me, and I'm sure all our listeners alike. So thank you so much for being here today. And we wish you all the best.
Thank you so, so much. I look forward to what this can bring and the support that it can bring to parents as well.
And that was Kelly Grace sharing her incredible insights and heartfelt wisdom with us today. It's clear that raising resilient, kind, and confident children isn't about perfection. It's about presence, patience, and prioritizing connection. To our listeners, Remember that every child is unique, and so is every parenting journey. Whether it's through small daily actions or big intentional decisions, you have the power to shape a brighter future for your little ones. If you've enjoyed today's episode, be sure to subscribe and leave us a review. And don't forget to follow us on social media for more parenting tips and resources. Until next time, this is Progeny Patha reminding you to embrace the journey, celebrate the small victories, and most of all, enjoy the magic of parenting. Bye for now.